It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And every afternoon at this time, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as we begin the program, well, I'm looking forward to hearing the topic. I haven't even been told what the topic will be. We'll find out. With that, good afternoon to you, Cecil.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
And to Wes, good afternoon to you as well.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon.
So what is the topic today?
We have in our office a great deal of estate-related work.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when the folks die and then the real property, their home or possibly condominium, is a subject of their, of course, plan of action in terms of their testamentary plan, their last will and testament. But in the meantime, maybe a child is living there. Maybe the child won't vacate the property. Maybe one of the children or even one of the relatives move into the property. And so we have these situations where we have folks occupying real property, houses, if you will, Lockwood, really not under a, you know, written lease agreement,
right.
Just under some claim of title, so they say, or claim of right. And so Wes and I kind of want to talk about that. This topic can go in a lot of different directions. First of all, just general landlord-tenant, of course, law, which I think we should touch on. But right now, we'll start off with the concept that when property is owned by, you know, two or more people, be it children or grandchildren or combination of the two, it's known as tenants in common ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And tenants in common ownership is a very interesting concept in that the person who has a tenants in common interest, and maybe Lockwood, again, this could be a third, this could be, you know, a 25% interest, a 50% interest. It can be any interest in property. It could be a 1% interest
mm-hmm.
in real property. They have the right, believe it or not, at that point to then occupy the property.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that interesting? I mean, who would think that someone who has just a minority interest in property can go and, you know, move into, if you will, or stay on holdover on real property? And the idea here is that they really have, under the law, the tenants in common is described as a part but the whole, a part but the whole. And so we are called upon by other owners in the property who then say, well, you know, my brother won't move out of the house.
Right.
He's continuing to live there. What are we going to do about this?
Right.
And so that's one of the topics Ooh. We kind of want to address today. And then just in general, where does the line draw with trespass? And I'd like for Wes to kind of address that. Sometimes in our office, we even amongst our staff, our lawyers in the office will debate, well, is this a trespass action that we're going to be filing?
Ooh.
Or is it really just more of a landlord-tenant matter? So those are some of the topics, and off we go. Wes, what are your comments right out of the gate?
Well, the factual scenario that you laid out, you indicated that, you know, there's a lot of estates that we're dealing with. We were having family members or individuals who are remaining in estate property.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this is property, and I don't, as far as what I do in the office, you know, I'm primarily, you know, litigation. I do definitely touch other areas, but estate administration, which is, you know, handling someone's estate when someone passes away, I definitely am involved in that. But Cecil, Andrew, Julia, those are some of the attorneys who really are more dealing with that on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that type of scenario, they deal with those issues, and then sometimes I'm brought into those because we have this, as Cecil referred to, as a holdover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a holdover is kind of a general term of someone who is staying in a property who doesn't have a right to be there. And I guess this is a situation where folks, someone's passed away, and the person is, you know, in the property, and we have to deal with it in some way. So, have to analyze that. You know, initially we have to determine how was the property owned, because like Cecil touched on, you know, if it's tenants in common property and this person has a percentage interest in it, then, you know, they have a right to be there. It doesn't matter how small the interest is. It's not a majority vote type thing. Like, if we've got someone who has a 10% interest and the 90% owners say you have to get out, well, that's not the way it works. The 10% owner has a right to be there. That's where we get into a partition action, where it would be, you know, a forced sale, that type of thing. But as far as determining what legal mechanism to use when you have a holdover like this, if there is an actual lease agreement, or there's an actual landlord-tenant arrangement where the person was actually paying some rent or some type of compensation, usually on a monthly basis, to stay in the property, then that's going to send you down the road of small claims court and a summary ejectment proceeding. That's in small claims court, that's the majority of the type of cases that the magistrates deal with, which is you know, landlord-tenant law and ejectment of folks who have not paid rent or who have breached their lease. So, but in many cases, when you have a holdover in property, especially an estate, and I've dealt with all types, you know, boyfriends who are allowed to stay in the property, or a friend who was there, or, you know, even a, you know, a child or a grandchild, you know, it could be, in, you know, any type of relationship where the deceased allowed the person to stay in the property or lived with the person, but now the person has passed away, but they just continue to hold on. Well, the people who have the rights then in the property, whoever the property was in fact left to, I mean, if it was left to the kids and the boyfriend is still in the house, well, the boyfriend's going to have to make arrangements to move on out. So then the question is, okay, if there's not a lease, then what do we do? Well, that's a trespass. That goes into a different category, which is, you know, a lawsuit for trespass. Now, the problem with that, or the problem that can exist with regard to that, is that your landlord-tenant situation, the law is set up so that you can get a very quick remedy. You can get to court usually within about 10 days for your trial on summary ejectment, so you can get possession of your property back, because the, you know, the law really supports highest and best use of real estate. And if someone is not really trespassing, but they're in a landlord-tenant situation, but they're not upholding their bargain by paying, their end of the bargain by paying, then, you know, the law is going to support you to get them out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but in a trespass situation, it's not really set up to move as quickly. So what we normally do is we normally will file the trespass action in Superior Court and file a motion with that for a preliminary injunction. And what we're asking for is possession of the property. And what that preliminary injunction is basically is a injunctive remedy, or a remedy in equity, where the court can just say, okay, well, Mr. Collins has proven here that there's a likelihood of success on the merits. That's one of the standards. It's a kind of a buzz phrase. And that there's irreparable harm. That's another buzz phrase that you need to prove with a preliminary injunction. And therefore, since he's proven those things, I'm going to give his client, who apparently has title to the property, possession of the property during the lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And the court, in many cases, will then grant, you know, that preliminary injunction, as long as you prove that you own the property, you have the right to possession of the property. This person doesn't have right to the possession of the property. That there is a likelihood of success on the merits and there's irreparable harm, and the irreparable harm will be, I have a right to possess it, but I can't because this person won't even let me in.
Mm-hmm.
Then the court will enter that order, and that in many cases resolves the whole lawsuit right there at the beginning, at the preliminary injunction stage, because what we were concerned about is this person holding over in our property and us not having possession, and although it's a temporary order that gives us possession, well, once we have possession, as they say, possession's nine-tenths of the law.
Right.
Well, we'll just change the locks, and the property is ours. We use it as we want.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a, you know, it's kind of, you have to, you don't need to be too broad in the way you think about how to deal with these remedies, because if you don't really know how to deal with these as an attorney, and you end up in court, you think, well, this person's in the property, it's got to be a landlord-tenant. And you go to small claims court, and there's no evidence of there actually being any type of rental of the property, then you'll be dismissed out of court, and then you got to go figure out what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that would, you know, properly send you down the trespass route. So,
Lockwood, we have these... We have files where we have, you know, we've had many files where, you know, there's the holdover, again, kind of generic terminology by the girlfriend, the boyfriend,
right,
the significant other. Wes was involved. I was involved in a very contentious situation here recently where a son, an adult son, you know, probably 45, 50 years old, suddenly died. He did have a live-in girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
His estate passed on. He did not have children. He did not have a wife. His estate passed on back up the ladder, as we say, to his father, a very upstanding gentleman. But lo and behold, this gentleman, who is not young, you know, has lost his only son, and now, of course, has inherited the home, but with the girlfriend in it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was not real cooperative about moving out, No one expected her to move out within a week or so of the death of her boyfriend, but to make arrangements with the executor to move out. She locked out the executor, her boyfriend's father, if you will. There was evidence that maybe she was moving things out of the house or taking possession of certain personal property that he, electronic equipment that he happened to have, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that is the way in which a case like that can frame up factually. And I think that listeners out there can say, oh, yeah, I know about that. That happened in my family. Another case that we've had, which is fascinating, we had a caregiver of all people. A caregiver, this elderly lady, allowed a caregiver to move into her home under some sort of arrangement or pay, and it wasn't real clear. And, of course, that always then creates the issue. And then, lo and behold, when the relationship deteriorated for whatever reason, the caregiver would not move out of the home and thought that she had some, you know, right, title, and interest to continue to occupy the residence, the room, the bathroom, and the den where she had been staying for a while. And then, of course, she had all sorts of her personal property in the home. And so it was very difficult to get resolution in this because she, of course, thought that certain things had been, had been destroyed by the owner of the home or had been misplaced or mislaid. And so she was alleging that she was going to counterclaim on these things. So like Wes just said, possession is nine-tenths of the law. And when we let folks into our homes and it's not clear exactly what their legal position is, their legal title, if you will, then we open ourselves up to these kinds of cases. It's interesting, isn't it, Lockwood?
Oh, it is. You know,
that we see these, but we see a lot of cases like this.
You know, the interesting aspect of this, and we're talking really the common theme is real estate, real property. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And I do want to remind you, the location, 1107 Bridges Street in Moorhead City. And I want to give you that number very quickly, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. Or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please. Again, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and we're talking about real estate and the issue of real property. And if you will, I'm going to paraphrase sort of a description of this, Cecil and Wes, and that is distribution of that real estate. And, you know, you mentioned earlier in the program, tenants in common, and that raises a very interesting aspect. But first and foremost, you've got to have a clear document based on our earlier conversation a few moments ago that declares who the owners are. I cannot just simply walk into a building, provide services, and then say, well, for my services, I determined that I am a percentage owner in this facility, this structure, a long-term caregiver, for example, as you mentioned a few moments ago. So there needs to be clear identification. Am I correct on that? There needs to be a documentation, in other words.
Absolutely. That's right. And these cases come at our law firm in terms of we really have to do an extensive analysis on the front end. I think Wes was alluding to that. In other words, what is the right title and interest of this possession? What is it? Is it landlord-tenant? Is there a lease agreement? If there is, then good. The lease agreement is going to control. At least we have that.
Right.
Is it tenants in common, meaning that this is an heir to an estate that has a percentage in the property and is therefore claiming their possessory right because they own a portion of the property? That, of course, is going to frame up, as Wes mentioned and as we've talked on a program before, into a petition to partition or to divide that property. Because, after all, the other owners of the property are not just going to allow this one owner of the property to stay there, you know, indefinitely, not pay rent. How about taxes, insurance, upkeep, all of those kinds of things? There's a great remedy for those set of facts, and then we run into kind of these hybrids where, for some reason, the girlfriend, the boyfriend, the caregiver, the whoever are just under the impression that they're going to continue to stay in the property, even though there's not a lease agreement, even though they're not a tenants in common owner, that they just are claiming some possessory right to the property. And so we have to analyze the cases very, very thoroughly on the front end and get the square pegs in the square holes and the round pegs in the round holes, or else we're going to have a problem in the courtroom.
No, you mentioned earlier the term remedy, and that was Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us. How do you, if you've got a situation where there was an understanding, a promise of some nature, is there is that something that can potentially injure that? I say use that in term injure that can pose a problem for removal of an individual who does not have documentation for any percentage ownership in the facility. Is there ever a situation where it's really a common understanding, that sort of thing?
Well, that's in the caregiver context. That's interesting you bring it up, because with a caregiver context, that's what you always hear.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we don't have caregivers all over that often, but when it happens, and it does happen, and maybe a dozen times, 10 times, 5 times. I mean, it's not frequent that we've seen this. Normally, what the caregiver says is, well, she told me I could stay here as long as I wanted to.
Right.
That's normally what we hear. Blackwood, that's basically worthless.
Okay.
Not basically. It is worthless.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got to understand that when the person passes away, in many cases, they're either going to have a will or a trust. They're going to have an estate plan that's going to indicate, okay, I leave my things to my children or to my husband or to the church or to whom, to whomever they want to leave their things to, including this property that's in question. So that's the way that operates. The title to that property then passes pursuant to that estate plan. If they don't have the estate plan, it's going to pass through intestacy, meaning the statutory procedure based on who your family is, that's who the property is going to pass to under the North Carolina General Statutes. Well, under either one of those scenarios, you know, normally folks aren't leaving their property to their caregiver.
Right.
And certainly under intestacy, the caregiver is not recognized. It's going to be family members that are recognized. So as the attorney who's handling the estate, and we're cleaning up these things, this estate administration, you know, oftentimes what we're needing to do, as we talked about, is make sure that the property, the possession of the property, is correct.
Mm-hmm.
So if we just have a caregiver who is saying, well, she said I could stay here forever, or as long as I wanted to, or for a month, or for 6 months, or whatever, well, the obligation that we have as the attorney is really to whoever holds legal title to the property. And that's going to be borne out by these documents or by intestacy. And so if the person, I mean, in many cases, we might communicate with the caregiver and say, look, the family's fine with you staying there for 30 days. You know, even though you don't have any right to stay there, we don't want to give you time, you know, to get your things together and to transition to somewhere else, that kind of thing. We want to be reasonable with regard to that and not necessarily, you know, spend money going to court when 30 days may do it. But if the title owners, you know, want to proceed forward, then this caregiver coming to court and saying, well, she said this or she said this or he said this or he said that or whatever is not going to carry any weight at all. Because the title holders are the individuals who make the determination. Now, if the deceased, if they wanted to include something in their estate planning,
mm-hmm.
estate plan for the caregiver, that's certainly up to them. Sometimes folks do that. Sometimes people will leave a life estate to a caregiver or to a friend or even leave property to a caregiver friend. If that's the case, well, that's fine. That's what we have to go with. Because ultimately, we're trying to carry out the intent of the person who owned the property. Because this person has passed away, they have set forth what their intent is. And if they don't, if we're not in really the business of trying to guess what their intent was.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is. And it's either in your documents that you put together, or it's through intestacy, which is very easy to, you know, determine by simply applying the statutory framework. So another aspect of that is that, you know, someone coming to court and saying, well, the deceased said this or said that with regard to my right to stay in the property, not only does that not carry any weight from a material standpoint as far as how the title would pass, it's not admissible anyway under what's called the dead man statute.
Hmm.
I mean, because this person is testifying or trying to testify as to what a deceased person said to benefit themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that type of testimony in North Carolina is not admissible. It can't come in. It's not, you know, if you make a proper objection to that type of attempted testimony, then the court would properly not consider it. So, again, you know, when we're dealing with real property and how it passes and who has the right to possession and these kind of things, you know, documentation is everything.
You know, that's Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and Cecil and Wes are joining us. We're talking about the issue of real property, actually, the transition of or transfer of real property. You know, the other aspect of this, and I know this probably is going to lead to yet another conversation, and that's the topic of those family members. Let's say we have five family members, and the property is now divided, just say equally among the five members, each owning 20%. But one of those family members has been residing in the house, probably as an assistant, maybe even as a caregiver, for example, for the deceased. The question then goes to how do the other four property owners say, okay, we need to sell this house, But the person living in it says, wait a second, I'm not going to. I want to stay in this house, and I'm not interested in making any other financial arrangements. How do you go about dealing with that issue, Cecil, Wes?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a classic petition to partition or to divide the property. And the first thing that usually would occur is that there is attempt to make an agreement, a negotiation, if you will, an understanding as to, well, how long is this one child going to stay in the property? What are going to be the terms and conditions? Are they going to pay rent, insurance, upkeep, taxes, things of that nature? If there cannot be communication and there is an absolute impasse in the family, and yet, as you say, Lockwood, this one person, it was one family member, is occupying the house to the exclusion of all the others, then that, of course, is going to be a classic frame-up of a petition to partition or divide the property. And we've had a program on that, and it might be time to have another program on that, but I sometimes like to talk a bit philosophically, and what I want to say here, Lockwood, is that you can imagine that this happens frequently.
I bet it does.
Okay, when people inherit property, brother, sister, siblings of three, siblings of four. I mean, we have a file in our office right now that we're working on diligently where there are seven owners in this Atlantic Beach cottage, okay?
Right.
They aren't even brothers and sisters, and there are issues. But the point that I'm trying to get at is that the law, the philosophy of law, is going to have, as you would expect, Lockwood, a very fine, if you will, fine-tuned remedy to this problem. Okay, I mean, a petition to partition action is a special proceeding that begins in the Superior Court pursuant to a very specifically outlined and detailed statute.
Okay,
and the reason there is a statute and there is such detail and there are even pre-printed forms, if you will, by the office, by the administrative office of the courts, whereby parties can gather up these forms and file them. And the reason for that is because this is a very common problem, and our law is not going to support the deterioration, if you will, the destruction of real property. Real property carries a tremendous amount of clout in the law. The land, the houses, it's a very important proprietary interest. The law recognizes that, and we are going to have procedures whereby we can make sure that the property is in its highest and best use, and that there is not the weight of one particular family member or one particular owner that is keeping this property from being at its highest and best use. I mean, who's going to pay the taxes? We let the taxes go into delinquency. Who is going to maintain the property? It's then going to become a nuisance. So the law recognizes that there has to be a remedy, and a very good one, and there is. So that is what would happen in that case. Wes and I are always bringing in petition to partition files, you know, every week, every couple of weeks.
Really?
There's just always one or two of those that are happening because property is many times owned by more than one person.
Cecil, I want to go to, this leads to another observation here, but first I want to go to a question. You said, and I obviously this does show that the court, or the state, if you will, sees the value of real estate, because right out of the gate, you said it goes to a superior court action. In other words, it just doesn't go through the district court, civil court, district court kind of program. It goes right, this is my description, right to the top of the list. My question to you, in the superior court action, is that a trial involving witnesses and a jury, or is it more of a, I'll use the term probably incorrectly, administrative kind of address to the Superior Court?
Well, it's kind of more of a quasi-litigation type file. A partition goes before the clerk of court.
Okay.
So the clerk makes the threshold determination as to whether the party has the right to partition the property, determines, you know, if it's going to be sold or if it's going to be divided. If we're talking about acreage that could be divided, and we're talking about a number of owners that are not too significant, then probably the property would be divided out in kind. But in many cases, we're dealing with a house or a condo or something that can't be divided. So we're talking about either a private sale where it's listed with the realtor and the proceeds are then divided among the owners, or we're talking about a public sale in certain situations where it's sold on the courthouse steps based on a bidding process. So there's a lot of moving parts with regard to it. And there's also the right to for equitable adjustments. Like if one of the owners has been paying the taxes for years, they would have the right to be reimbursed for those expenditures, insurance, maintenance, things like that. If a party has received rent from an owner from the property, they would have to divide that rent with the other co-tenants, co-owners. So it goes through the clerk's office, and then there's multiple layers that are dealt with before the clerk, and that's where that's dealt with. The appeal of that is to the Superior Court if anyone appeals any aspect of the decision.
All right. Before we are going to be wrapping it up here, I want to make mention that was Wes Collins. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins on the whole issue of real estate, but particularly the distribution of real estate and among family members or among, if you will, interested parties. That would be those who own a real interest in the property, but also the potential for false, I will use that term, false ownership, that is not having a documentation. One final question for you both. You know, much of this seems to me could be and should be handled really at its genesis, at the beginning. And that would be, for example, distribution of real estate among family members that would determine that upon a certain event, let's say the death of the gift giver or the owner, that it is handled sort of in a mechanical way. Is that the best conclusion or best remedy for this sort of thing, Cecil, Wes?
Well, the best remedy, yes, is to, I think what you're saying here is to have a plan.
Right.
I mean, because if you don't have a plan, then we have confusion potentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we have a plan and we put it in writing and it's clear, and that then we just carry out the plan, even though there may be these steps that we have to go through, because we may have someone such as a caregiver who's a holdover who doesn't necessarily agree with that plan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just the way the world works. I mean, we have those kind of situations. But if we don't have a plan and have some confusion or have some ambiguity, then it can be a more complicated process to deal with either a landlord-tenant situation, a trespass situation, a partition situation, any of these type of remedies that we've touched on today.
That's Wes Collins of Harvell & Collins, and we were talking earlier also with Cecil Harvell. I want to remind you always to avoid these kind of conflicts and challenges, and also actually to save you time and money, please think about contacting an attorney, and particularly Harvell & Collins. And I just want to remind you, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or online at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. Wes, Cecil, to both of you, thank you very much for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Okay, thank you, Lockwood.